We continue now with the mother and daughter team that has co-authored a sequel to the groundbreaking Diet for a Small Planet published 30 years ago. The new book is Hope's Edge, the next Diet for a Small Planet, and the authors describe their worldwide travels to groups who are solving hunger by dealing with the root issues of democracy, community, and the reinvention of capitalism. Frances Moore LaPay and Anna LaPay are my guests. And, we left off in the last interview discussing the Brazilian man who'd heard the Brazilian media's characterization of MST, this landless peasants movement, as, these folks being radicals and subversives and what have you. Then he meets them. He realizes that's a lot of jive. And you can almost see on his face, I'm guessing, a sort of cognitive dissonance, which you talk about in the book. You talk about these thought traps in the book. We talked about them briefly in our earlier discussion, but when someone has their belief system challenged, whether it be a 30-year-old or 40-year-old belief system, it's like, wait a second. And, the look on their face must be just pure chaos.
And we saw a lot of that, and we heard a lot about people's moments of dissonance, we call them, because every place we went, people told us these stories about how there came a point in their lives in which suddenly they realized that the assumptions they've been operating on were false. And I think a lot of us have these moments, and then we have a choice. Do we sort of bury our new realization for fear of change, or do we take that leap, a leap toward hope, ultimately, and realize that we have to change? And we saw this, for example, with farmers in Wisconsin. One farmer, it was very poignant, he told us about how his father had died of cancer, and all the siblings gathered around, and they said, Dad died of pesticide exposure. None of the doctors would say that to us, but we know it's true. So what does this mean for us? If we're really going to learn something from this tragedy of losing our dad, we'd better let go of chemical agriculture and move toward organic. And that was huge for them because farmers want to look good to their neighbors. And when you're making that transition to organic, your farm field is not as tidy as your neighbors that it's pouring on the chemicals. And I remember this farmer said to us, we got laughed at. They said, our neighbor said, oh my gosh, what are you growing there, Jim? Pineapples? I've never seen such lousy-looking corn. So they had withstand, and I think this is the hardest thing for us human beings, to withstand criticism or being out of step as we follow our own truth.
David Masumoto did Epitaph for a peach, and he was a small peach farmer, and the peaches are now bred for shipping rather than taste, and that's one of the themes of the book. Hey, let's go to quality rather than quantity. And he says to view this, it takes a very simple shift. Instead of weeds, you don't have any weeds, you have indigenous growth. So if you look at it that way, there's not a problem. But it's that small shift. I want to talk a little bit about the Center for Living Democracy and the Small Planet Fund, a couple of organizations that you started. Can you tell us about these two efforts?
Well, the Center for Living Democracy is what led me to my current work, and it came out of a book that I wrote in the early 90s called The Quickening of America, which in some ways is very much the kind of the local version of Hope's Edge, because in The Quickening of America, I traveled all across the country looking for what is emerging, where people are taking charge and realizing what is in their best interest and acting on that. And so out of that, as Anna said, that experience then in the American News Service, which grew out of that center, led me directly to this, that since we are social animals, we take our cues from each other. And if all we see is people despairing or all we see are crime stories, what hope we have that our acts can make a difference? So really, this book, Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet, grew right out of the American News Service.
Yeah.
And the Center for Living Democracy.
And the Small Planet Fund is actually something we just created in the process of working on the book. We realized that we could use this opportunity to help channel resources back to some of the groups in the book. And as I was joking with a friend, I said, starting the Small Planet Fund for the first time in my life, I'm actually asking somebody else besides my parents for money, which started out as kind of an awkward thing. But I'm realizing that by asking people to contribute to the fund, that I'm actually giving people an opportunity to say thank you, to these amazing people that we met around the world who are taking often life and death risks.
Some tremendously amazing people. And why don't we talk about one of them in Kenya, the Reverend Timothy Is it Najoya?
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us about that? Yeah, you wrote a little blurb on him. Can you tell us
about that? I did, actually. Well, we met Reverend Timothy Najoya through Wangari Maathai, who was the founder of the Green Belt Movement, which we could also talk about. It was actually what brought us to Kenya, this movement that began with Wangari Maathai seeing the desert encroaching on Kenya and realizing something needed to be done. She started in 1977 with seven trees, and the movement grew into a nationwide tree planting movement of village women planting their own trees.
20 million of them by now.
And really pissing people off in the process.
Yeah. I guess I went to Kenya a pretty naive. I had this image of Kenya being this kind of safari wonderland. And actually, Kenya is run by a dictator, and who part of his power comes from selling off public lands, which are the forests, or encouraging the logging of those public forests for export money. And so through this process, Wangari and women in her movement and other people in her movement have actually come head-to-head against the government. She's been beaten. She's been arrested. She spent time in jail. And so what started as a tree-planting movement actually has become a pro-democracy movement of these women who before saw these forests as something they had no control over and had no right to, all of a sudden realizing that actually those public forests were theirs. And if the government was selling them off, they had a responsibility and the opportunity to step up and say, hey, wait a second, we need these forests. And so it became this pro-democracy movement with 6,000 hubs of the movement in villages across the country.
And the Reverend had fingers chopped off.
Yes.
He did a speech. He thought he was going to die after a speech.
Well, yeah, actually, we met Reverend Najoya at the Greenbelt Movement Training Center in Nairobi, and one evening he spoke with us, and it was, I think, one of the most powerful moments of the whole voyage together. And he explained to us how Reverend Najoya, like Wangari Maathai, was very critical of the dictator and very much for trying to create a democracy in Kenya. And he had been, as he called it, defrocked for some of his radical ideas. And he got, as he said, refrocked. And even though all of his friends said to him, please do not give another radical speech, your life could be in danger, he felt he had to. And he described to us giving this speech after his being refrocked and literally going home, he said, and waiting to die. And he described that evening hearing a knock on his door and these men. He opened the door and there were these men standing at his house, and immediately started attacking him. And they, he describes this brutal attack of, they chopped off several fingers. They were attacking him with machetes, and he describes, and he actually shows us by falling back. He describes falling back on his back, and actually catching one of these attackers on his legs, and it looked like to me like a parent kind of playing airplane with their kid. And he describes this moment of this man literally dangling above him, this man who was trying to kill him, this moment where something clicked. And again, maybe it was this moment of dissonance that we talk about in the book, but something clicked for this man who was attacking him, where finally that man saw Reverend Najoya as a human being, and they stopped attacking him. And they literally started
collecting his fingers,
and helping him. Yeah, and he described thinking he was about to die, and but yet these men said, you know, we did not realize who you were, and we didn't know this. People who sent us did not tell us this. But what was the most powerful thing for us was after that we said, but weren't you? We said, asked Reverend Najoya, I said, weren't you terrified? How did you live through that? How did you have the courage to give that sermon? But even beyond that, how did you have the courage to face your fear and defend yourself against those men? And he said to us that for him, he sees fear as not something to overcome. He described it like we could all be like the lion, who when the lion sees a predator or prey, it doesn't immediately attack. It first recoils and gathers up that energy and takes that fear energy, which Najoya described as neutral. It's just inside us. It doesn't have to then come out as fear. So it takes that fear energy, transforms it, and then lunges.
So this was such a powerful, powerful lesson for us that change is scary. Change, you know, we're talking about the state of the world today requires a lot of change. So how do we deal with that fear of being different, of changing ourselves? And I think this image that will carry with us forever is this image, knowledge that fear is just pure energy and we can turn it into courage energy. And that's what the people in our book are doing.
Yeah, and you know, we talk a lot about some of the travels around the world, which, you know, are exotic and great to hear about, and we need to hear about more of them. But, you know, here in America, we have problems. We have 2/3 of the world's advertising is spent here in America. And what a profound effect that has on our diet. Half the calories the average American eats come from fat and sugar, 50%, which leads to obesity and diabetes and other diseases. And one of the ways to deal with that, perhaps the best way to deal with that, is to deal with the young people, to teach them the right way. And the Edible Schoolyard is such an amazing, it's an early story in the book, and it's such an amazing story. And it's tied in with another Bay Area project called the Garden Project. Why don't you tell us about what's going on in the Bay Area?
Well, we had the delight of walking through a magical garden that had been created by children themselves, not by the teachers telling them what to do and how to do it, but by the children designing their own garden, planting the food, harvesting it, preparing it, serving it to each other, and in the process, learning all the science and ecology at the very same time. So what we saw then is children who, you know, well, what was so surprising is that the very first food that they decided to grow was kale. And Anna and I kind of laughed and said, gosh, we'd think kale would be the last thing that you'd introduce. And the kids loved it because they grew it. They harvested it when it was fresh, no bitterness. And they were describing how one little kid was hiding the kale under his napkin so he wouldn't have to share so much of it.
Kale hoarding in grandma's
kale kitchen. Hoarding.
Who would have thunk? Was it the black kale, the dinosaur kale, or lacinato kale?
I don't know. But we heard just on this tour, we heard another story of 22 school gardens, similar school gardens, but in the state of Tennessee. And the originator said, you never guessed what the favorite food of these children is in Tennessee. And I said, well, I probably wouldn't. And she said, turnips. So I think we have to drop our preconceptions that children just automatically run to this terrible fat-laden food, that is the propaganda, that is the result of the incessant advertising, not something that is just natural to us.
And eat empanadas instead of Taco Bell, which is one of the recipes in the book, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yes, it is.
We've
yeah,
got
that's
recipes
what they're
in the book,
day.
Too. We have recipes in between each chapter that are illustrations of the different places we went, as well as 100 pages of recipes from some of the leading vegetarian whole foods cookbook authors and restaurant owners who've sort of carved the path ahead for vegetarian cuisine. And as I say, you know, it's just amazing to see the how this cuisine has developed over the years and the decades. Yeah.
And on our website, you can find out where all those restaurants are and the cookbook authors who've contributed to our book so generously.
And that URL again is?
It is www.dietforasmallplanet.com. And you also can find out about all the different groups and how to contact them, all the different people we visited on our journey around the world.
All the different resources, which are amazing. Let's go back to the Bay Area for the Garden Project. Now, a police captain named Ron Roth, who had his own transformation in his career, he says that it's much more efficient when you look at prisoners doing gardening. When you look at one unreformed addict coming back out into society, stealing cars, you go through all the insurance, all the hassles, $500,000 in a year, and yet we won't spend 30 grand to send this guy to college for 1 year. It doesn't make any sense.
And I think this goes back to that myth of scarcity. We're told we don't have enough. We can't provide all the services we need to provide for people in this country. And then you look at, well, wait a second. What are we wasting when we're building more prisons and schools, when 7 out of 10 people coming out of the prisons in California go back to prison after they get out. So when you want to talk about scarcity, we can talk again about the waste of those resources when you're creating the system that's creating perpetual prison inmates.
And yet this garden project that we visited, we saw ex-convicts, people coming out, and if it hadn't been for this project, they would have been lost and probably going back into the addictive and criminal behavior. But instead, they were learning to grow food, not only to feed themselves, so they were getting healthier, but they were also sharing the food with poor people in their neighborhood. So they had that incredible self-esteem builder of being a giver and not just a taker. And we just felt and we saw their lives transformed for a tiny fraction of what Captain Roth said society would have paid if that same person had gone out on the street again to steal cars, etc.
Yeah, it's an incredible small percentage of that, and they become nurturers of life rather than takers of life.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And I was just speaking with Catherine Sneed, who's the founder of the Garden Project, and she was telling me that this year, actually, a lot of the government funding for this project might be cut, actually, or some of it they might lose some of that funding, and it was just so frustrating to hear because it is such. Goes back to our common sense. You know, this actually makes sense to reconnect, especially in her community. It's a mainly African-American community. And she said for her, it's about also reconnecting these African-American communities to traditional African-American foods. Again, like kale, greens, those kinds of...
Collard greens.
Collard greens. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, you talked in the earlier interview about 90% of the resources in America being wasted. Well, there's just the powers that be write off a certain percentage of the population as disposable human beings and wasting that resource. Talking with Frances Moore LaPay and Anna LaPay, the co-authors of Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet. I'm Paul Nelson. Another amazing person is Muhammad Yunus. He founded the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. We've talked about this on the show before, but he has some amazing thoughts, and that is that one day poverty is going to be resigned to the museums. He believes that.
Well, talk about a moment of dissonance. This man really had one because he was an economics professor and had returned to Bangladesh after the war for independence there. And the country was experiencing an incredible famine, and every day he would walk to his economics class to teach and walk by dying people. But every day he kept saying his lectures about economics, and then one day he said, wait a minute, what I am teaching, how does this help the people dying along the path I walk to class? And so he said, I needed to become a simple person again. I cannot help people as an economist, and I must become a simple person again. And that realization that he needed to look with fresh eyes was the beginning one of the most ingenious things we've ever seen. He actually enlisted some of his students and said, well, let's go out, and ask the poor people why they're poor. And so he went out into the villages, and the poor people made it very clear, the reason we're still poor is we work hard every single day, we labor and labor, but we're indebted to the moneylender who takes all the profit. So he said, well, what do you need? You need a bank that gives you a loan at a reasonable rate. But then the banks wouldn't give loans to poor people because they didn't have property, they didn't have collateral. So ultimately, he helped create a bank for and by and owned by the poor people. And now it has loaned money to 2-point-something million villagers, poor women.
Microloans. And we're talking, what, $30, $40, $100, $200?
Yes, exactly. And they repay the loan at a much higher rate than the wealthy going to the traditional banks. But what was so interesting to us when Muhammad Yunus said, well, you know, people ask me how I came up with this design for the bank. And he said, well, I just looked at every rule of banking, and I turned it upside down. So this capacity to look with fresh eyes is what was so remarkable.
The notion that banks have a social impact, so you might as well live up to it and have a positive one.
Exactly.
Tell us about that. I mean, if you went in, you say in the book, if you went into Citibank and said, give me a loan, they said, well, do you beat your wife?
Right.
It's crazy. And yet they, you know, the notion that we're separated from the effects that we have, especially as a bank, is just absolutely ludicrous. But that is, you know, the logical outcome of this machine mentality.
Machine mentality where everything is dissected into its tiniest parts. And so in Bangladesh, they said there's no reason why a bank can't also have a social motive. And so the borrowers, these poor women who also own the bank, they said, well, let's come up with a set of pledges to kind of call all of our borrowers to a higher level of being, of what they really want to be. And so they developed 16 pledges they call 16 decisions. So they involve everything from sending your children to school to not inflicting injustice and not allowing injustice to be inflicted upon you. From that to building a pit latrine or an outhouse. I mean, they range across from basic health measures to fundamental questions of right living in community.
And despite their success, they're based in a huge building in a big city in Bangladesh. Women in Bangladesh, there is more violence against women.
Yes.
If a woman turns down a man's advances, she gets splashed with car battery acid. And also the numbers of women working at the bank, the Grameen Bank itself, are going down.
Yes. And this was one of the most disturbing things to us, that when we were in Bangladesh, I think we were still caught up in a naive notion that while there are many negative things about the intrusion of corporate materialism into these cultures, that at least maybe it would give people some images of more liberated women. But what we learned is that the consumerism, all the billboards and the advertising that we now saw, say, in Dhaka, Bangladesh, it was whetting the appetite of men for material goods, for consumer products. And so the dowry system, which had been dormant or really insignificant, was booming, where men now demanded huge sums from the bride's family, and not just one time, but over the life of the marriage. And if the wife's family didn't come up with the cash, then the men would actually torture the women. So if you overlay this kind of consumerism in a culture where women are devalued, you don't end up increasing the status of women.
No, but you also see women in a commodity culture as being another commodity to be consumed.
Exactly.
It's really pernicious.
And actually, one of the 16 decisions is, I will not accept dowry. I will not give dowry in my daughter's wedding. And it was interesting, as we were talking with women, how even though they made that pledge, how difficult it was to butt up against those social norms. And we saw again and again women admitting that they did pay the dowry, that they felt compelled to, they felt they had to, they had no choice.
But some taking real pride in the fact they had not paid the dowry. Mm-hmm. So it was that solidarity by setting new norms.
There's so much in the book to talk about in Europe, productionism and getting past that notion of productionism and multifunctionality, which is a term that came up, which reminds me of my permaculturist friends, but we're out of time. Dietforasmallplanet.com is the website.
It is.
And I wish you continued success. It's a delightful read, and the recipes alone are worth buying the book. Thank you for being on the show, and continued success with your work.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Frances Moore LaPay and Anna LaPay are my guests, and they're the co-authors of Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet.